Today on Movie Wallahs, our fifth and final episode from Tribeca 2016. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, D as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Boy.
It's over.
I know, right? It's been a heck of a film festival.
Wow.
What was our final tally? It's got to be like 30.
I think
plus.
It's in between 20 and 30, yeah.
Wow.
And I think what we're going to do is on our website, once this episode is posted, I'm going to put a list of all the movies we covered with the links to each of the episodes.
Fantastic. That would be great.
Yeah.
And we know that some already have release dates.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the film festivals come and go, but it's always a shame that some of these movies never see the light of day. So I'm always actually super excited when some of them do. The Meddler, I know, has
it's been just opened.
First Monday in May.
Yes, Alive Cargo has opened.
Ooh, that was one that I wanted to watch.
Yeah.
So, yeah, cool stuff. All right, well, we have five films to get through in this episode. So we're in the tradition of our other Tribeca podcast. We're going to skip our Netflix picks and just get straight into the reviews. The five movies are The Banksy Job, Bad Rap, The Loner, Jeremiah Taher, The Last Magnificent, Enlighten Us, The Rise and Fall of Arthur Ray. I think I did that without butchering the names of those. So
that was quite a mouthful. Well done, Joe.
it really was. Put my teeth back in now. So let's start with The Banksy Job.
So The Banksy Job is directed by Ian Roderick Gray and Dylan Harvey. And here's the description from the Tribeca notes. Simultaneously hilarious, wild, and bizarre, The Banksy Job further illuminates the crazy world of street art and the peculiar relationships between the artists, in particular Banksy, and the artist known as AK-47. An art world mystery caper, The Banksy Job adds another wacky layer to the Banksy story, and one that can't be missed. This was a movie that all of us saw, and we had to kind of do a lot of
hustling
to get into the screening. We couldn't attend the press screening for this one, and so we wanted to get tickets to see the regular screening of it, and we were till 3 minutes before the movie began, we weren't sure if we would get in.
Well, just by virtue of the fact of having Banksy's name in the title meant that this was pretty much a sellout as soon as the ticket sales opened. So Banksy is notorious, and in an art city like New York, the mere mention of the word Banksy, I think, generated lots of excitement. So yeah, we managed to squeeze into this one at the last minute.
Yeah,
thank you very much to the publicist team for
letting us in. Now, I love Banksy, so this one was high on my list, and I was really disappointed when we couldn't catch the press screening. But I'm really happy that we got into the screening itself. So shall I kick off then?
Yeah, why don't you tell us what you thought?
So I guess overall, this was a fun caper of a movie. It was entertaining in the moment. But I kind of feel like it's a wasted opportunity. And the only reason the movie's been made is because it has Banksy in the title. I think this artist, AK-47, only exists because Banksy exists, and he's not very likable as a character. And so I kind of found it a little bit overall a bit of a waste. Entertaining, but I guess I was a little disappointed overall.
Yeah, disappointed is the word I have in my notes here as well, because I think the movie, to go a little bit even further than what you said, I think it kind of misappropriates Banksy's name. I mean, I know this particular artist, AK-47, is trying to kind of play with what Banksy has done and so forth. But it kind of, the title implies that it has Banksy's involvement and there isn't. And yeah, I agree. This AK, I don't know what to make of this AK-47. He seemed like a publicity whore to me. He was just doing and saying things which were so out there and so bizarre, trying to kind of almost you know, ride the coattails of Banksy. I mean, it is fascinating. It's incredible that somebody would actually do this in that kind of way.
And go to all those lengths.
Right, go to all that length. But outside of that, yeah, a little bit of a disappointment.
Joe, what did you think? Because you also like Banksy.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no getting around the fact that putting Banksy's name in the title is a great way to generate publicity for your small film. And, you know, it's justified here. I think what they've created is tangentially related to the world of Banksy. And so I think, you know, that was enough for me to kind of let them get away with that. As cheeky as I think it was, ultimately, I think what we had otherwise here was, I mean, it was a fascinating portrait of this crazy AK-47 character. And I think he
almost runs this underground, like almost like the Fight Club. Yeah, but it's kind of like the art club.
This guy self-parodies. Like, there is no need to do anything in terms of editing to make this guy look anything other
than... He's a caricature.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. It's hard to know what to make of him if you think about it for a minute. He is somewhat avant-garde in his thinking, but it seems so inspired by Banksy that, you know, he ultimately is somebody about whom one would never have made a movie, but for the fact that he did, you know, pull off a little bit of a reverse heist, which I thought was interesting. And the movie does a good job of keeping you entertained throughout the whole process. I mean, I really liked the subversion of all of these kind of artistic topics that's in here constantly. And it doesn't necessarily make me think about what is and what isn't art. I mean, art is very subjective to...
And personal.
And personal to many people. But it still kind of exists within that Banksy universe, right? Where we look at things that people create and assign value or not. I mean, you know, the whole the thinker, the drinker, the stinker, whatever this statue was ultimately called.
Yeah,
you know, is it art or is it not? You know, Banksy himself plays with that idea. You know, some of his prints are absolutely worthless without verification. Yet, the moment you know that he actually did them, which he may or may not have done, the value goes up enormously. And so it plays with some of those concepts. And I had enough fun with it to let it be.
I think that's the lost opportunity, Joe. Like, I wish it had delved more into... I mean, we all know art is so personal. And when an artist dies, something does or doesn't make them famous. And it's the same as saying, you know, I found a sketch drawing that Picasso did versus I found a sketch drawing my grandmother did in the attic. I wish it had played with that a little bit more. It felt a little bit too whimsical. And I think if it had delved into that, why is Banksy so valuable? Yet AK-47, who is doing the same thing. Yeah, and I agree. Building on what Banksy's created, not as valuable. So lost opportunity, but I agree it was very entertaining and I did have a smile on my face. And I was actually sat near, I think, a lot of the crew, but one of the major producers, I think, who was sitting next to me actually fell asleep during the movie.
Well,
I think that may have been because he was drunk, but
it was a bad movie. It was a late screening.
Yeah, it was a late screening.
And he's probably seen it many times already.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny when I sat down, he said, "Oh, you're not Banksy, are you?" And I said, "Yeah, don't tell anyone." At which point he just looked at my face like blankly.
I mean, the one thing I will say is that, you know, this whole art terrorism that AK-47 does is completely motivated by financial reward.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that the movie does draw that theme out in many ways. I think he's just trying to make a buck and get by without really working for a living.
He's almost thuggish. I mean, and like I said, I didn't mean it lightly when I said he has this kind of underground movement like Fight Club, which is called the Art Club or whatever they're called. But I mean, it's literally an army of people who help him thug around and do, you know, miniature crimes, really. I didn't care for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think
and we weren't meant to.
That was my single biggest problem. I didn't care for him at all.
Yeah. Yeah. If, I wish he'd been even a little bit more charming, but he was almost too comical as he a just, caricature to be endearing.
Just, yeah. He just seemed too manufactured to me. I think even he probably doesn't believe that he's real. I think.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Correct. And that, I think, again, it's in his mind, he's subverting the art world, you know, in. What we're seeing is a derivative of Banksy.
Right.
That is very hard to take seriously in any way. Right. Okay. Movie number two then is Bad Rap.
This is one that I really wanted to see. This is directed by Salima Koroma, and it follows the lives and careers of four Asian American rappers who are trying to break into the world that often treats them as outsiders. In sharing dynamic live performance footage and revealing interviews, these artists will make the most skeptical critics into believers. Well, we'll find out from Joe if they do or not. With humor and insight, the film paints a portrait of artistic passion in the face of an unsung struggle. And it's true, we don't often see many Asian rappers, I guess, but you know, if you look at the hip hop movement, there are a ton of Asian dancers who are incredible and win all those competitions. So, Joe, was this good? Or will you give it a bad rap?
Well, you know, as a rap rockumentary of sorts, it draws into light a number of questions around our ethnic biases when it comes to certain type of music. And rap is clearly seen as a black art, as in, you know, most of the big rap stars are, you know, African-American in origin, they're black. Whenever you see a white rapper, they're some kind of phenomenon, right? The whole reason that Vanilla Ice or Eminem, you know, received so much publicity was because they were, you know, non-black rappers. And so you enter this world of Asian rappers. So these are, you know, Asian American youth. These are people who have been raised within the United States and they've gotten into hip hop as their preferred artistic medium. And they're trying to get around some of the essential biases that we have when you think of the Asian kid in school. You know, he's the one pulling all the A grades, you know, super good at math, you know, nerdy, you expect him to drive a Honda Civic and all these kind of racial stereotypes that we have. To be a genuine hip hop artist is so far from our preconceived ideas around, you know, the Asian American culture that this is what this movie is really trying to get into. And it follows a couple of different rappers. One by the name of Dumbfounded, the other one the name of Awkwafina, and it follows the world around which they live. And you know, some of these guys are extremely talented. Dumbfounded has developed a huge reputation on the battle rap scene. So he comes up with these spontaneous raps in confrontation with others, and he's taken very seriously because his rhymes are very good. He's spontaneous. His command of the rap art is spectacular.
Like, would we consider him Eminem good?
Yeah, no, he's well respected. I mean, he's been on MTV and other places. But in terms of you know, being accepted as a hip hop artist and selling CDs and, you know, seeing him you know, in the rap you know, section of MTV, he doesn't have the right look. He's a nerdy looking Asian guy, and that doesn't fit with our image of you know, the badass gangster rap. And even though the words that they say and the actions and the lifestyle is very much the, you know, the black African American rap, it talks to the struggle about how to market these guys.
Right.
There's a brilliant scene in the movie actually where they get a number of industry label types. I guess these are people who listen, you know, scout for records, and they play them these artist raps. It's not clear in the movie whether or not they know whether they're Asian or not, but I think the key disappointment for me is ultimately that these guys, as talented as they are, they don't bring anything new to the genre.
Right.
And so I think their frustration in not getting picked up as artists is compounded and, you know, confused by the fact that they have this racial stereotype. So in their mind, they're not getting anywhere because they're Asian, but only one of them really had enough of an edge to get picked up. And that was what the producer said. I mean, she had a real attitude in her writing that was above and beyond what we were hearing everywhere else. I mean, everyone's heard, you know, drugs and guns and bitches and hoes. You know, we've heard those kind of things all the time, and it takes something new to differentiate yourself. Right. So if you're Asian trying to do that, it's not going to work.
Right.
But, it, you know, I had a lot of fun with this one. And
good soundtracks? Did it have like a good...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it talks about, you know, some basic history of hip-hop. But, I mean, the movie at times feels a little bit like an SNL skit.
Right.
Where you're seeing the out-of-place person in the world. And I think that's the point it's trying to make. Our preconceived ideas as to who can be a hip-hop star and who can't are so... defined by what we see in the media, that it's very difficult for us to accept. You know, it's like, you know, a black mariachi singer.
Right,
you know, you,
right.
It wouldn't look right. You would laugh.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting debate because you can be on the other side of the argument, and when you're looking at an art form which is so quintessentially specific to a particular culture or
right.
ethnicity, on the other end, you can almost regard it as appropriation.
Hmm.
You know, so a lot of people have issues with, you know, people wearing American Indian headgear as part
right.
of, you know, they find it very offensive, that it's offensive to the Native Americans for you to wear, you know, that headgear for a
yeah.
for a party somewhere. Whereas that person just thinks of it as, you know, liking
a nice
that
headpiece.
A nice headpiece and yeah. liking that culture. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
so at what point do you open up, you know, I mean, a lot of black music, you know, kind of originally came black, and then eventually some of the white artists
yeah.
started doing soul, and it's harder.
Absolutely.
And somebody like Macklemore, I'm thinking right now, even now gets so much flack for, you know, not being authentic enough, you know, and
yep.
I was absolutely shocked to find out that outside of the southern states, the place where country music is the most famous is Australia, and most loved is in Australia. And it's so bizarre to me when some other completely... random, you know, group of people seem to love something which is so specific
yeah.
to a
yep.
particular group. So it's fascinating.
It's great. I mean, you know, I would recommend this movie only in that it opens your eyes to your own personal preconceived notions about what looks right, what sounds right. And, you know, for that, I applaud the movie. I think these guys ultimately are going to struggle. They struggle because it's difficult to market them. And, you know, the movie doesn't really resolve any of that. It just kind of opens your eyes to, you know, the world of rap and how inherently, it's going to sound straight, but how inherently racist it can be mm-hmm. to be the wrong ethnicity trying to break into that field.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. Let's move on then to movie number three, which is The Loner.
Okay, so Yazdi, I think, was the only one that saw
no,
this
Joe
one.
Saw it
oh,
as well.
Joanne Yazdi saw
I
this one.
I managed to
okay.
sneak into this one.
So this is directed by Daniel Grove. And Daniel Grove's neon-soaked feature debut follows reformed mobster Behrouz, who is haunted by memories of being a child soldier in Iran in the 1980s. As he pursues the American dream in Los Angeles, Behrouz finds it increasingly difficult to stay away from the seedy underbelly of the city. Grove's neo-noir, as it's being described here, is a smart, action-packed and colorful thriller with an electrifying score. So, Yazdi, what did you think of this? Sounds like I would like this one.
You know, it... Right in front of our eyes, unbeknownst to us, there has been this whole new genre of films which has emerged, which is of Persian filmmakers kind of taking on, we were just talking about this previously, but taking on many of the typical cinematic genres. Last year, there was a movie called Inappropriate Behavior, which was almost like a Sex and the City kind of thing that the Persian filmmaker did, and she's now on Girls. There was a great little vampire movie called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night,
mm-hmm.
which was this black and white vampire film made by, did you watch it?
No, I didn't, but yeah. I really want to.
Made by an Iranian
yeah.
filmmaker. There was, Marianne Satrapi's, you know, she did, what do you call it? I'm blanking. Persepolis. It was based on her own book that she wrote about growing up. So it seems like there's this whole other genre of Iranian-born or affiliated filmmakers taking on a genre, and I think this is one more in that particular direction.
Mm.
And this one is about and a person of Iranian heritage mm-hmm. who kind of gets caught in a mobsterish and, you know, environment. And it's kind of playing homage to John Woo movies, you know. Oh, it's kind of paying homage a little bit to Travolta. Not Travolta, sorry, to Tarantino, sorry, wrong right. T. to Tarantino, film noir, etc. Unfortunately for me, this was a complete 100% absolute failure. I could not stand 5 minutes of it. These are my notes.
Oh, this is all where I met you after, and you were like, I kept deciding, should I walk out, should I walk out?
I honestly considered walking out like 15 minutes into this movie. I mean, here are my notes. Are they kidding me? What nonsense is this? What the? But anyway, Joe, tell me I'm wrong.
So, I mean, look, I'm not going to tell you that I love this movie either. I think I struggled to get through it in part because I think the writing and some of the acting was just a little ropey. You know, it didn't fit together well. It didn't mm-hmm. generate enough love for the character and his predicament and the situations he was trying to get through. So, yeah, technically, I think the film had a lot going for it. I mean, it's shot in this very stylistic neon, you know, mm-hmm. dark lit kind of LA. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's my imagination or not, but the whole thing felt very kind of smoky and almost black and white. Yeah. But for the fact that it had these, you know, blue and pink highlights everywhere. So I think it had a very good look to it. But yeah, narratively, I really struggled to really go anywhere that this film was trying to take
me. So what, was it implausible or it was just taking too many leaps in the story? Or so
for me, it was very much entrenched in the noir genre. So I'll say that is not my favorite genre. Mm. And I always struggle with them. I mean, even Blade Runner, which is, you know, the kind of the classic sci-fi movie that is very inspired by film noir, that would be Ridley Scott, Harrison Ford. I mean, it's supposed to be a movie tailor-made for me. I've always struggled with Blade Runner, and this had that same kind of, okay, I'm bored with the way that this story is being told.
Mm.
I think the movie just did not, and I feel bad to even be mean about this. I mean, somebody's put in a lot of heart into it, and somebody's very inspired by these kind of filmmakers, you know, John Woo and Tarantino, and maybe a little bit of Michael Mann as well, now that you're mentioning it. But it just lacked narrative strength. Mm. I mean, the story was going nowhere. It was just creating mm-hmm. situations where, you know, there's intrigue for the sake of intrigue, and then new characters come on, and it just didn't all come together. I really had a problem with keeping up with the story. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense of deliberate artifice to it.
Mm.
I mean, it felt kind of artificial. And I suspect it was very deliberate, but it didn't work for me at all. And, you know, there was a great movie. I think some of us, I know I saw, again, another Iranian movie we saw at the LA Film Festival last year called Atomic Hearts. And that movie...
No, I think you were the only one that saw that. Yeah,
yeah. Does this wonderful fusion of, you know, the vampire movie and the crime movie and the friend movie. And it's, you know, again, it's trying three or four different things, mashing them up. And you would think that it would not all come together. And it does, because it's so inventive and it's been written so well. This one, it didn't feel
mm-hmm.
very put together. And I don't know if it was just the tone.
Mm.
No, it was exactly, it was all of the above. And, you know, I'm just looking at my handwritten notes here from the actual screening, where I've written just plain weird !! I mean,
yeah.
it just goes off the rails at some point. Maybe that's excuse me. Maybe there's something metaphorically there that I'm not tapping into. Maybe there's
like
something...
Holy Motors weird or
no
okay.
no
okay.
Just I mean, Holy Motors is a whole other level of weird. Episode, whatever that is, look it up on MovieWallers for a great debate. But no, this is just disjointed weird.
Mm.
You know, it flips in tone from section to section. You know, there's that whole scene with the Russian mobster.
Yeah.
It doesn't hang well.
Yeah, it was the second movie I saw that day, and I was reasonably alert. And halfway through the movie, I felt like it was the sixth movie I was watching that day. Mm. It
dragged.
It kind of filled my head with that stupor. It kind of filled your head with like, I need sleep. I need to sleep right now. I don't know. Maybe we should move on. You know,
yeah.
We've kind of beaten this one up too much, but it didn't work.
You know, but that said, I think, you know, again, the look and feel of the movie shows some talent. I mean, it's shot. I think the budget that they had was reasonable. I think, you know, this isn't to say that this filmmaker should give up and go home. Yeah. I think, you know, with the right material and the right handling, there were some really, really well set up shots. And I think the other comment I wrote was that it did feel in some ways like a showreel for different styles of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I'm just looking at Daniel Grove's IMDb, and he's done a fair bit, but nothing big, I guess.
Okay.
And he's fairly recent, so maybe this will be one to look out for in the future.
So, yep.
Yeah.
Moving on, Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent.
Yeah, so I was the only one that watched that, and of course I went with delight because it's a movie about...
Go on.
...a chef. Jeremiah Tower is probably the most celebrated by chefs, but most unknown to anyone who isn't. He is the revolutionary of American cuisine in this country. He is equally quirky as he is a good cook. This is a really interesting documentary about a guy who's had a really incredible life.
Hmm.
I would describe him as someone who was highly privileged in his youth. Spent his life on yachts and cruises with his parents. He learned to love cooking through looking at menus in these five-star establishments as a six-year-old. He lived in the Ritz. He lived in like the Waldorf Astoria. And he would literally be allowed to go down to dinner at the restaurant on his own as a six-year-old and would literally live in the kitchens there. So it's a fascinating story about this very interesting man, made even more amazing by the life he's led, where he turns up in Berkeley in this very famous restaurant called Chez Panisse, mm-hmm. Where he meets this very interesting hippie-like woman called Alice Waters, mm-hmm. who then basically works with him to create this amazing American, you know, they basically revolutionize American cuisine. And then she supposedly steals all his ideas, dresses them up in a book, and it becomes one of the most famous cookbooks.
It was, yeah, of the time in the late 60s, I believe. Correct. Early 70s, yeah.
And so then
vegetarian
it just feels,
cooking, right?
No, it's just general cooking from Chez Panisse. And it fuels this man's anger to the point where he then decides that he's going to leave. He starts his own restaurant. His restaurant becomes something like, you know, Studio 54. It was called Stars. It becomes the most famous establishment in San Francisco.
Hmm.
And, you know, then this guy disappears off the face of the earth. And then, like, literally within the last 5 years, he's invited back to Inn on the Park. I think it's not Inn on the Park. The famous restaurant in Central Park. So anyway, it's a very interesting story about people, I think. And then, you know, there's a lot of food porn as well, which I loved.
I think I would love this one.
I think you both would really like this one because it's intriguing. It's about privilege, and it's about, even though we perceive that someone who is born of a certain status in life, with everything available to them, how miserable their life can be. And what's really important? Is it about having parents who love you and support you and nurture you? Or is it about having access to anything you want? Mm. At the expense of not having the love and nurturing, but you have all of these resources available to you. Brilliant documentary, very, very interesting. Really good, you know, talking heads like Anthony Bourdain, mm-hmm. Martha Stewart. I think Mario Batali's in there. There's some really amazing chefs talking on this guy's behalf. And he himself is just incredible.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, that's not a name I've heard of. And I won't say that I'm among the cognoscenti when it comes to the culinary art. But still, you know, from what you say, he sounds like he has been so influential, and yet, in fact, the movie bills him as the one of the most influential figures in American gastronomy, yeah. whose name has been largely obliterated from history.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's fascinating to me that can even happen.
Absolutely.
Great stuff. Final movie of the day and of the film festival for us was Enlighten Us, The Rise and Fall of Arthur Ray.
So again, I think I'm the only one I saw this. Go on, Yazdi.
No, do you want me to introduce
it? Yes, please do.
So Enlighten Us, The Rise and Fall of James Arthur Ray, was directed by Jenny Karchman. And the description is as follows, that the self-help industry is worth $11 billion a year. It captivates those seeking happiness, release from suffering, and those longing for a path and a leader to follow. James Arthur Ray, for many, was that sort of a leader. But when a sweat lodge ceremony, I have no idea what a sweat lodge ceremony is. I guess
you don't want to know, yes.
You'll let me know. But when a sweat lodge ceremony goes horribly wrong, we learn from Ray and some of his followers that their spiritual path was fraught with danger and perhaps even greater suffering.
So again, I must apologize because I was so excited to speak about Jeremiah Tau. I didn't even let you do the intro.
That's fine. You did a great job. Yeah.
Okay. So this one fascinates me. I am completely fascinated by groups of people who get swept away into these cults, right? And that's kind of what I read the log line to be, a way to try and understand what it must be like to be part of a cult. It wasn't that.
Oh.
I think what this is this guy, Arthur Ray, is more, he fancied himself like a Tony Robbins. And okay. he made his initial success because he was part of The Secret. Many people in this country, many people around the world have had access to The Secret, and it sold, you know, millions of books and audiobooks. And people kind of swear by this vision, you know, vision, envisaging your life, putting things out there in the universe and then the universe giving them to you. So he's kind of more of those motivational speakers. I think that's what he fancied himself as. And I think what happened is he just got a bit carried away and he was good at it. And really what happens is that he decides that there's these things called sweat lodges. And the idea is that you go into a tent that's heated up to a certain temperature, kind of like Bikram yoga. Mm-hmm. If anyone's done Bikram yoga, it's heated to a certain temperature. And the idea is that you sit through the sweat, and through sitting through the sweat, you detox. Okay. And also you learn sort of how to control your emotion, and you get rid of, it's kind of like a purging process, I guess.
But are you alone there, or are there other
people? No, there's like 150 people in there with you. And unfortunately what happened on this instance is, and, you know, people had to get the right sign-offs and, you know, they signed away waivers and things. Unfortunately, three people died in the sweat lodge.
Oh, wow.
And that's what ended up making him have, he ended up on a manslaughter charge.
Wow.
So basically, you know, again, the whole point is, you know, as adults, are we responsible for our behavior in these situations? Like if we go to an exercise class and we've just had a hip replacement, is it our responsibility to take care of our physical well-being, or is it the instructor's? I think that's the central argument. I think he got caught on the wrong end of it. And unfortunately, you know, he lost his way. And so he ended up doing time in prison. And wow. Now he's actually trying to make a comeback. So he's done years in prison. He's paid for his crime. And he wants to make a life for himself again. And he believes that,
as a self-help person.
As a self-help person, because the skills that he had, and clearly he was helpful to a lot of people. So it kind of explores some of the people who were kind of like his disciples. And then it spends a lot of time with him and his family as well.
From what you've described, the movie sounds very sympathetic to him. I mean, it seems controversial to me that you could put somebody in a situation where they might die. And you know, so it was his intent to push people beyond where they could push themselves?
Well, that's really what came out during the court case. So there was a very apparently televised court case where basically each of the people who were in the tent were asked, you know, when because they were near the people who actually died, what was happening. And, you know, I guess when someone was feeling a bit sick, he just said, come on, power through, kind of giving them words of encouragement. And then again, it comes down to this, well, what's your personal responsibility? If you're feeling really sick and someone says to you, come on, power through, do you put all your faith in that person that they know more about your body than you do?
Yeah,
and you guys, it's that whole, I mean, kind of, yeah, trainer-student,
teacher-student. I work out with a trainer, and there are times when, you know, I have to kind of...
You have to take responsibility, right?
But there are also times when I just feel like, you know what? I mean, it's why I'm here.
Yeah.
Right?
I think what was most interesting to me is...
It's difficult.
It is difficult. Now, you guys are pretty stable and sensible, right? So I imagine... And I know that both of you have recounted times when you say, look, he's pushing us too hard, and we say no. I think in this situation, you know, people who go to these things are generally people who are lost in their lives, and they truly believe that this person is going to be the answer to their prayers. And unfortunately, I think there are people who feed on that and make a lot of money out of that. And so he had this, you know, four-step process where he will make you into a guru, and each weekend away costs a ton of money, and people get certified. And I think it was a good exploration into these self-help things. It certainly wasn't the cult type movie I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting.
No, fascinating. Yeah. It's one I'd love to watch. I mean, I read a lot of these type of things. So, you know, it's fascinating to me, just the whole premise.
Yeah. And it was interesting, you know, he is very open about some of the techniques he used to not convince people, but to help people. I think it's interesting that a lot of people are just lost in life and they're goalless and don't understand. You know, they get themselves in a difficult situation and they don't know how to get out of it. And so often these people are the people who are good at doing that.
And what about the filmmaking? I mean, is it a well-made?
Yeah, it's a well-made documentary. It's very entertaining. It's not funny. It's not one of those kind of, oh, let's poke fun at these people. It's a very serious look at something that went horribly wrong. But I think I came out of it thinking, and it's not sympathetic to him, Joe. I just think it was very unfortunate. It's a very unfortunate set of circumstances that led these three people to die. Interesting movie, though.
Okay.
A lot of documentaries this year.
It was very documentary heavy. I don't know if that's just my pick. I mean, you know, it's documentaries are somehow less of a risk when you're at a film festival, when, you know, narrative films can go wildly to the polls, whereas a reasonably cut documentary, you know, because of our conditioning to reality TV and this type of thing, you know, I think. But that, you know, you pick the topic that's interesting and off you go. But it was a great film festival. I mean,
oh gosh, yes.
I think, what an amazing
the amount of content of there movies. This year was just you know, extraordinary
and so rich.
And we were there for just 5 days. We were there only through the first half of that,
correct,
of the film festival. And I know we missed so many good talks. I mean, we were able to attend the one with
J.J. Abrams
and Chris Rock, yeah. But there were so many others with Jodie Foster and
Tom Hanks
yeah. and John Oliver and
Mark Ruffalo.
And then there was the Taxi Driver anniversary screening, yes. Yeah. With Robert De Niro and all of the cast, Scorsese. And so, yeah, we barely tapped into a portion of it, and yet we came away so
fully satiated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
good meals.
Yeah,
well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, film festivals, you've got to be kind of hardcore to travel for them, but you know, something like Tribeca is, if it's in your backyard, then you know, gosh, exploit the heck out of it. It's really time well spent. And you know, we always say to folks, you know, go to film festivals, support these things, support these wonderful ways at airing movies that you might not otherwise get the chance to see. So, you know, we'd like to thank the Tribeca folks again for a very well-run film festival.
Yes, and for giving us our passes.
Yes.
We were, once again, privileged to cover it for them, and do hope that the filmmakers that are getting our critique are not too offended by some of the things that we've said. But, you know, that's part and parcel. I mean, you know, these movies don't get publicity in any other way. So film festivals are an important way for discovery, to see what new talent is coming. You know, go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is there one movie that you...
I knew you were going
to
ask.
I had to ask.
I would have to look back across all of them. I think Detour is a bit of a standout for me,
yeah.
In the sense of it felt the most polished of the movies that we saw. So I'm going to call it before Yazdi does.
Damn it. Damn you, Joe.
What about you?
You know, Mother keeps coming to my mind. Mother and Parents. And they were the two foreign movies that we watched.
Yeah.
Just outstanding. Both. Sorry, I cheated. I said two. I can't choose between them. Different structure, acting, original. Story.
Very original, yeah.
beautiful to watch. Yeah, stunning. Parents and mother.
I was going to say Detour because I think, like you, Joe, that I would love for this movie to break out and get the kind of recognition it deserves because it's so smart, just in, by way of its structure. And it's not over smart that it annoys you. It's smart in that it genuinely surprises you.
Mm.
And so I want this movie to become more of a household name. I want people to find it. I hope it doesn't get lost in a 2-week release and 4 cinemas in every city. I really hope they don't mess this one up. But seeing that you already picked Detour, I'm going to pick Little Boxes, which I had spoken about, I think, in episode 3 or 4, which it was the movie with the most heart that I saw at the Tribeca Film Festival. And even though it has nothing to do with my own situation, I just identified with every character in that movie. And, you know, as sweet and big-hearted as it is, it also has a very sharp eye in terms of pointing fingers at how we as a country are losing sight of our creativity, of our culture by, you know, what's happening in mainstream America and allowing our culture to be, you know, to be bastardized. So
so
good stuff.
Great point. And that's the other thing. What don't we get at film festivals ever?
Yeah.
To my knowledge. Sequels.
Yes, I mean, that's right.
Know, this is a terrific environment for seeing, you know, fresh ideas and things you haven't seen before. So, you know, concepts and stuff that maybe, you know, doesn't quite work, but you know, these people are putting their art and their energy and the effort. I mean, the sheer perspiration required to get a movie from concept through filming, through production and post and to a release is
and then accepted by a film festival. The bar to even get accepted by film festivals
so
these days.
Every single one of these so filmmakers high. Has achieved something and it should be celebrated.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it is indeed celebrated by me.
Well said, Joe. Well said. And also, I was very pleasantly surprised the other day. For those of you who have Amazon Prime, there is Amazon Video, which has pretty good content now with movies and TV shows. TV shows, both original as well as, you know, those from other outlets. And they have a Tribeca section in it. It is an extra subscription that you pay. I don't know if it's $5 a month or $3 a month or $7 a month, but it exclusively shows movies which were shown at Tribeca.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, you know, for those who are kind of looking for that, you know, non-sequel, non-Hollywood, mainstream kind of stuff, there are some incredible gems in there, including some older movies. So I'm glad that, you know, I've always thought that wouldn't it be great if I could have a film festival-like experience at my home every day when I come back from work and I have 3 hours. I would love to watch a new movie. And if there was some way, you know, that movies which get only shown at film festivals and don't get distribution, if there was a channel or an outlet where you can watch them, that would be great. I know I would sign up for it right away. And it seems like Tribeca is kind of following somewhat in that in along those lines.
I think they also have a channel on United.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Yes. That you can get on United if you're ever flying United.
Yes. Yes.
So. Yeah, no, that's always been the great promise of the internet. Every movie ever available at any time. But it's the curation, I think, that gets difficult. And as we regularly talk about, Netflix can be problematic.
Well, just getting the three of us to agree on anything.
Well, just trying to find stuff in Netflix. So I love the idea of, you know, these film festival organizers, they get many, many times the number of films that they select ultimately. So the job that they do of curating is a difficult one. And I think, you know, Tribeca does a particularly good job of you know, getting rid of the not so good. And you know, whether you like it or not, there's usually something interesting about every entry.
Yeah.
Okay. So that wraps up our coverage for Tribeca 2016. Until 2017, where we hope to once again cover Tribeca. Thank you again to the organizers. I'm going to sign off. It's a good night from me.
And me.
And me as well. Goodbye, Tribeca.